So happy to be able to join this online meditation retreat. I'm currently in Indonesia at the moment and coming here to join the Asalaha Puja ceremony in Borobudur, considered the largest monument in the world, or Buddhist monument in the world. And they asked me to give a short or a bit of a talk to you all. So, sort of didn't really bring too much equipment or anything. So, hopefully, this will work okay. Very happy to say a few words on Dhamma to you to give some encouragement. And especially at this time of Asalaha Puja, it's a very special time that we recollect the great importance of this day. We all know about Vesak Puja, and usually that's the largest celebration in the world where we reflect on the Buddha, his life, his enlightenment. And this Asalaha Puja is the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, where the Buddha first revealed the Four Noble Truths. And from here, we are very fortunate that it was able to be, you could say, transmitted the teachings to another individual in this world. So someone else, apart from the Buddha, could actually see these Four Noble Truths and attain to that same Dhamma that the Buddha saw and realized under the Mahabodhi tree. And so this was the turning or the setting forth of this Dhammacakka, this wheel of Dhamma. And so we're very fortunate that they say the Dhamma wheel will keep turning and will be unable to be stopped by any individual, any human being, any ascetic, any Brahmin, anyone at all, any Mara, Brahma, any Dewa, they're unable to stop this turning of the wheel of Dhamma. And we can see this that it's spread from under the Mahabodhi tree from India and spreading to all our different countries, that it's come to here, Indonesia, coming to Australia and wherever that you are as well. That's a great, great thing that it's being able to spread in this way. And so we're able to realize it, this Dhamma in our hearts. And this Dhamma is something that we can realize in our very life. We can realize it right here in the here and now. It's not something that we have to wait for next life before we realize the Dhamma, realize Nibbana. It's something that we are able to practice, to realize, and to have come up in our own hearts. Recollecting about my own life, I was born in Sydney, and there wasn't, well, I didn't really have much Dhamma at all for, I could say, the first probably 22 years of my life, and they didn't teach it in school, so I had really no access to it at all. And so my life back then was just sort of enjoying whatever pleasures, trying to build the world. I had everything quite was reasonably well off, didn't have any lack whatsoever. And so everything was very easy, considered quite a lot of happiness, a bit of, maybe a bit of suffering here and there, but generally everything was pretty good. But it was maybe a way that eventually would lead to a lot of suffering. And I was very fortunate that my mother started a Buddhist center because she had access to the teachings of the Theravada tradition, and she got faith to start a Buddhist center because she thought that other people couldn't access the teachings in Sydney, Australia. And so it so happened that the job of driving the monks was fell on me, and I had to look after them. They may come for a whole week and stay with me, and I had to attend on them, offer them food, and drive them around and to the teachings and to places around Sydney. And so that was something that back then I thought was forced on me, and I didn't really want to do it. But I guess in the beginning, we all kind of need someone to pull us in the right direction, even though we don't really want to go there, but maybe they know what's good for us. And so my mother was one who helped me, forced me in that way. And I remember that I wasn't really interested to listen to, you know, what the monks were teaching, maybe like all of you, very interested for maybe a long time already. For myself back then, I wasn't really that interested. But I remember that there was one monk who was quite nice, a Western monk, and I felt maybe bad that if I just leave him when he's going to give a teaching, so I should go in and listen as well. And I remember that he gave a teaching that I couldn't give an answer to, and he asked, "What is the highest wealth?" And back then, I was thinking from my own perspective of, oh, it must be a lot of money or a lot of jewelry or a lot of possessions, or maybe a lot of power. All this was what I thought was wealth. And he said that contentment is the highest wealth. And that was one of the first, or was the first teaching that really struck me and made me sort of step back and investigate the Dhamma a bit more and say, oh, you know, that is so true. It's when the truth is presented to you, it's something that you can say maybe gives the mind some peace. It goes deeper into the heart, and it can cut through even a lot of delusion. And I reflected that, oh, it's true. If someone has a lot of desire, wanting, they want to get more and more things in this world, then even if they have everything or a lot, if they still want more, then they can't really be happy. They'll still have suffering. And so that was something that, oh, yeah, if someone is contented, no matter what they have, then they can be happy, or at least not suffer from that. So that was something that made me really interested in the Dhamma. And I then learned, or tried to learn, a lot by reading books and learning about Four Noble Truths and what the Buddha taught, basically. And everything that I read and felt like it was definitely true, and there was nothing that I felt like could be sounded wrong or anything, or that I had maybe doubts in. And so I remember then trying to keep the five precepts, because I read that that's what Buddhists should do, keep the five precepts. And so trying to practice that, and in the beginning maybe a bit hard, but I remember that there was once when I was really trying to keep it, and there was once when it was very difficult to do it, and that was when I was working and I had something that I needed to sell, and someone offered a price for this, like $15,000, and then someone else later on called up and said, oh, I'll give you this price, which was something like $18,000 or a lot more. And all I had to do was tell one lie and it would be okay. I would have easily taken that much, $3,000 more. And, you know, I would have that just for one lie, or for just breaking one sealer for that time. And so I was back and forth and the mind very hot, trying to decide on what to do. And I remember then just deciding firmly that whatever happens, I'll just keep the precept, I won't lie. And even taking 3,000 less or loss, then I'd be happy and content with that. And so I did that, and it felt very peaceful once I had made the decision to do that. I remember that was something very clear arising in my heart, that, oh, this is the letting go of that desire, and that leads to peace. And so the Buddha had said that greed or lobha is something that gives you harm, or that makes you harm yourself, harm others, or harm both, and leads to mental pain and suffering or sadness. But when one lets go of that greed, lobha, this desire, this wanting, then one won't harm oneself, one won't harm others, and one won't have mental pain and sadness. And the Buddha said that this is the teaching that is visible in this very life. And so we can see the Dhamma then in times like that, when we're practicing and we're able just to let go of some of our greed or lobha, our attachment, and it gives us peace, and we can really clearly see that in our hearts. And that we can say that is Dhamma arising then in our heart as well, right then and there. And so later on, I remember I was in university or doing my master's, and I was maybe practicing in that those small ways, trying to keep sila, but never really meditating. And only later on that my friend, I had a uni friend, and he told me, "Oh, let's go to this meditation retreat for 3 days, 2 nights, 3 days like this." And it was on the weekend, and I thought, "Oh, I'm going to spend my weekend doing this. Not don't really want to, waste my weekend." But he convinced me. He said, "Oh, just be a friend and let's, go together." And so I thought, "All right, I'm just tag along kind of thing, and just join you." And I remember that what the advice the teacher gave on how to develop one's meditation, watching the breath, doing mindful walking meditation, I just followed that, and I really felt that was these ways to develop mindfulness was really beneficial. And just sitting there one night, and I remember the mind becoming very peaceful, and it was like I could compare the peacefulness compared to the mind how it usually was before that, which was all agitated all over the place. And so this is why Venerable Ajahn Anand will say that the just a small bit of peace is just so valuable, just because it enables you to compare what the peaceful mind is like and what the unpeaceful mind or normal mind states are like. And when you have a bit of a taste of peace, then it really gives you a lot of inspiration, motivation to keep going, and to see that, oh, there's something definitely here, and we really want to carry and build that more and more. So I remember that the mind got really peaceful, and with that mindfulness, that even getting up from meditation, I could just see that these mind thoughts just sort of coming up and ceasing. And it was like kind of as if it was like bubbles that were coming up and then popping, and bubbles arising and popping, forming and popping. And it's like, oh, this is a lot of suffering when the mind is kind of thinking agitated like this. And you could also see the impermanence of that state. And it was really, you could say, got a lot of peace just from that awareness or knowledge of that. And I remember then that gave me a lot more motivation to practice. And I followed the teacher's advice back then, was make a determination in front of the Bodhi tree to meditate for an hour a day. And that's what I did. I would meditate then after work, or 1 hour a day, no matter if it was busy or had a lot on, it was peaceful, it was not peaceful, but just because I'd made a determination to do that, then I'd follow that through. And that was a lot of sometimes difficult, but sometimes could do it. But then I remember one day that it was just sort of sitting once, and this perception of impermanence came up. like seeing what I already had, those possessions or wealth or even relationships or life, the body, everything sort of seemed very impermanent, as if it wouldn't last, something like life would end in death for sure. And it was kind of like, before maybe I saw it like it was a shiny ball there that was really attractive and you really want to get it. That was like the world and everything about it was like that. But then when one got a bit closer, then one saw it kind of like a hot iron ball that no matter where you try to touch, that it just burn you. And so there was no way that you could safely touch it. And so some weariness, you could say some wego, or just this sense of urgency, dispassion sort of come up. And I just knew that I had to ordain. It was kind of strange because before that I didn't have a thought to ordain. And then I did so on seeing that. And so this perception of impermanence is very powerful, and it's something we have to develop, and we're trying to develop. And the more that we have this samadhi, concentration, firmness of mind as a basis, then the more this perception of impermanence can come up. And the Buddha said this perception of impermanence is something that is very great. He compared it to like when the sun comes up, it emerges on a cloudless day, a cloudless night. The sun emerges up and it dispels all the darkness away. And this darkness he compared to like the ignorance, attachment to sensual pleasures, wanting rebirth, and this conceit of, or thinking, or this holding on attachment of I am, this is me, and this is mine. And so that's that sort of the powerful nature of this perception of impermanence that we're trying to develop. You can become to see things way more clearly. And so from there, then I had to find somewhere to ordain. And that was more of my problem. Didn't know where to go at all. Never really been to any other monastery except the one in Sydney. Never been to Thailand, or at least never been to any monastery in Thailand. But I went to, or my mom took me to visit this very senior Dhammaduta Thai monk, Thanchogwu Mahasamay. And then he was there that he said, where should you go? I'll send, go to Venerable Ajahn Anand in Wat Mapchan. And luckily I had the faith and the willingness to follow that. And I just left and decided that's where I was going to go. And it's quite fortunate that my mom had actually been there once before. And so she said, oh, I know that place. And she contacted Venerable Ajahn Anand sort of on my behalf, asking, oh, my son wants to ordain. You're gonna, will you be able to take him? And the secretary, or the one who could speak English, then firstly asked, oh, how long does he want to ordain for? And my mom never heard something like that before. So she said, oh, he's going to ordain for life. And a few days later, the monk calls again and asks again, oh, so how long did he want to ordain for? And then mom just said, oh, for the rest of his life. And then then said, okay, then, yeah, then he can come. And so eventually, yeah, my mom took me to Wat Mapchan. So I paid respects to these, the teachers around the northeast of Thailand, and then eventually went to Wat Mapchan, and my mom dropped me off there. And that's when I sort of began my training. Didn't really know what to expect. Before I went to Wat Mapchan, it was kind of this feeling that I'd never come back to Australia and just be entering the deep forest, and there'll be these tigers and snakes and elephants, and that was it. Sort of, you'd just be in there. So I didn't really know, had any idea at all what to expect, but I just knew that I had to ordain. And yeah, just, I guess luckily enough for me, it was, that was a good path for me. And looking back on it, I'm feeling very fortunate about that and having been able to be a student of Venerable Ajahn Anand. And the teachings he gave me as well. Yeah, in the beginning, I didn't really know how to practice, you could say. Just sort of couldn't speak Thai. I didn't know any, couldn't speak Sawadee-kap even. So just sort of have to have things translated. And one of the teachings that was translated was that you should put up your umbrella mosquito net and meditate under the root of a tree or under a tree. And that's how sort of the forest monks practice, you know, don't just always stay in the hut, the kuti. And then I thought, yeah, I'll give that a go. So went to practice like that and sitting under a tree. I remember in the forested part of the monastery is very dark, and it even released sort of pit vipers, snakes in this part of the monastery. I remember that I was sitting there and it was very dark. I think I had a candle on maybe. And then all these bats started flying in. And I remember there was just such great fear, terror coming up in my mind, thinking that I'm definitely going to die. And I was trying to recite Butoh, Dhammo, Sangho, it wouldn't work. And then just recollecting just on the word death and just repeating death, death, death. And somehow the mind sort of could gather together and be very peaceful and mindful, and the fear could disappear. Now I remember after that, it's like usually if you're kind of scared in your mosquito net, you don't want to move, like you don't want to get out, you don't want to go anywhere. But I could just go out and do walking meditation outside and very peaceful. And so just sort of mentioning this because, you know, for me that fear is bats. For others, maybe here it's like ghosts, or for little children, maybe the dark. But I think everyone's going to have some time in their lives that everything's going to feel very dark, and all the outer sort of refuges that we think we have, maybe possessions, power, fame, name, family, relationships, all this sort of thing that we've been holding on to very dearly, are not going to be able to help us at all. And we're simply going to be left with just our mind and our practice, what we have, you know, whatever we've developed in terms of our sila, samadhi, panya. And we're going to have to maybe just keep just the Buddha in mind only, the Dhamma, the Sangha, or our meditation object in our minds in order to hold on to and to overcome any fear, maybe sickness, or maybe times close to death. And that's the only thing we're going to be able to grab onto. So you can say that now you're training to work on your meditation object, your mind, so that whatever situation, experience, darkness that you're going to experience in the future, you'll be able to overcome it. You'll be able to have that peace, that faith, or the goodness that one's done come up and give one sort of firmness of mind and be able to dispel all that darkness and fear away from the mind, and there's just brightness there. So yeah, that's something that you can say you're doing now. I remember that I was there in, you know, what March, and maybe thinking of, had a time in my sort of monk's life where in the early on I thought, oh, we don't really need much luxuries at all. It's better to go very, you know, austere. And so I had glasses on, I remember back then, and I thought, oh, why bother having glasses? You know, the only important thing is the mind. Let's just watch the mind only. To look at things outside of one's just a distraction, and there's no point having them. So I didn't wear them anymore, and then I just practiced like that. And I remember one day I was walking back to my kuti, my hut, and it was kind of getting dark, but so I didn't really use a torch. And then there was this long stick on the ground, and I'm about to step over it, and I lift up my right leg already to step over it, and then I look down and I realize that, oh, that's a pit viper, that's a snake. And all I could do was jump off my back foot in order to try to jump past it. And this snake was very still, but could get up very quick and strike, and it did strike. Jumped out, lunged, and I looked back, I remember, and I just sort of can't believe how it missed me, but it missed me, and I was okay with that. But yeah, I remember after that, I was very, very scared of all the snakes or the sticks, any sort of stick, whatever it was, it'd be very scary even. And I just had that almost, maybe it's almost a phobia like that. Remember then later on one day, then this Ajahn nun came up to the close to the hall, and there was this other monk who was holding this wooden snake, and he came up and was kind of getting really close to me with this wooden snake, sort of slithers, in its way like that, left and right, as in this wooden fake snake. And I went by straight away, sort of, how to say, reeled back, saying, oh no, I don't like that at all. And then Ajahn Nun saying, oh, you contemplate that, contemplate perception. And maybe only later then realizing or thinking about it that, yeah, actually it is our perceptions, maybe things that we've experienced in the past that condition our present perceptions. So if we've maybe, for me, I had this experience of snakes, and then every stick or anything that's not even dangerous at all then becomes a danger, or maybe you start to hate it or have ill will. And if I didn't have sila, then I'd maybe, or just kill any snake. That sort of comes from this perceptions that we develop later on, because originally I didn't have that perception, but later on I did have that perception, and it was being scared of something maybe you shouldn't be scared of. And so just seeing that type of perception. But it's the Buddha gave a simile about another types of snakes, which is these four snakes that we are constantly looking after. And he said that someone is looking, they're looking after these four snakes, and so they have to come up every day and lift them up, the snakes. They have to feed them, bathe them, and then put them to sleep. These four poisonous, dangerous snakes. And then later on, whenever this one of the snakes get angry, then they'll come and bite you, and then cause you great pain or even death. And you probably know what these four snakes are. These four snakes are the four elements of the body. And so these snakes are something that we're contemplating, trying to understand more about. Because you can say that, oh, when later on the snake does bite, or the elements change and something comes up as sickness, as pain, as it doesn't go the way we want, then we're very shocked of, oh, why did that happen? Why me? Why is my karma bad, or what bad deeds did I do? But we're not understanding the truth of the snakes or the elements. It's something that we is already of that nature. And so people sometimes come and complain about, oh, had this woman come who had, he said she had cancer twice and is very bored of this samsara of birth and death, and she'd had enough of it. Having cancer is just so much suffering and didn't want to go through it again. And so I asked her, oh, if she has a life where she doesn't have cancer, good health, then would she want that? And she said, oh, yes, I would want that. And so it's not yet being bored of samsara, of the cycle of birth and death, but it's more just being bored of the suffering or the going around the world and then experiencing the suffering coming up and then disliking and not wanting that. That's, or it may be Ajahn Chah would say, oh, that's the monkey being bored, but not yet being bored of the monkey that jumps around from here and there, from suffering to happiness like that. And so really you can say that this is another type of perception that is, or that we have, that isn't yet right, because we have the perception that, oh, this body isn't something that is dangerous. We don't see it as being snakes. We don't see it as being something that will bite us one day. We love it. We look after it. We lift them up, as in we have to change postures, sitting too much, then we have to stand too much. We have to lie down too much. We've got to walk, etc. Like this. We have to feed it, you know, 3 times a day. We have to bathe it, shower it, otherwise it gets smelly. We have to put it to sleep a certain amount of hours a day, otherwise it gets exhausted. It can't go on. And so this is the what we have to do to look after it. But still, in the end, these things, it bites back and we experience a lot of change, pain, suffering, sickness from that. But the problem itself is not so much the cancer, the sickness, but it's just that we think it shouldn't be the way it is. We're attached to something that has to change, or that will fade, or that will break apart. And so we haven't yet seen the true nature of it. And that's what we're learning about, is trying to see the true nature of the body. And then when we know its true nature, then we won't suffer over it, because we understand, oh, this is the way it is, just like Venerable Anya Kodanya understood, oh, that's the whatever's of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease. And it couldn't be any other way. It's like an acceptance of that. And so the Buddha said, if we have moha, we have delusion, then we're going to harm ourselves or harm others, harm both, or and we're going to have mental pain and suffering or sadness from that moha, from that delusion, not knowing, ignorance. But if we are able to let go of that moha, that delusion, the ignorance, then we won't harm ourselves, we won't harm others, we won't harm both. We won't suffer, we won't experience mental pain and sadness. And he said, this is the teaching that is visible in this life, right here, right now. It's apparent right here. And so you can say, practicing towards this, and we may have been able to let go of delusion on some way, as in we had some delusion before and we're able to let that go, to see, to have wisdom about that thing and let go, then we can say, oh, the Dhamma already arose there. That was the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha that was visible to us right there and arose in our hearts. So we're trying to have more wisdom arise. And one thing that Venerable Ajahn Anand would recommend is to contemplate about impermanence maybe once a day at least, just taking an object, whether it's a part of the body, something around us, a material thing, and contemplate that and see that it's of the nature to be impermanent, that it's not going to last. And this is like training our perception of impermanence. And so the Buddha wanted us to build other perceptions up, so we're not just letting our perceptions just follow our habits, like the example I gave of myself with the snake, but we're building up wholesome, good perceptions that will overcome the defilements, the greed, hatred, delusion, the lobha, dosa, moha. So the perception of impermanence to overcome, or this delusion, ignorance, and have the perception of the loathsomeness of the body, or unattractive side, or the sort of negative side of things in order to overcome greed, to overcome attachments, holding on, and to have metta, loving kindness, goodwill, the perception of that in order to overcome dosa, to overcome sort of bad feelings, ill will, anger, hatred. And so these are perceptions that we are developing, and the more we develop them, then the more we can let go of these defilements, the greed, the anger, the delusion in the heart. And so, yeah, even one teaching can be very powerful if it enters the heart. We don't really need so much. Remember, there was a American chiropractor who came to Wat Mop Chan to practice a few days, and he was quite old already, maybe want to ordain, but he's probably too old to ordain. And so I remember Ajahn Anand gave him a teaching just to contemplate the leaves, and seeing that the leaves on the tree are just like us. They fall sometimes when they're young, sometimes when they're old. And so he, I guess, took that for contemplation, and the duties in the monastery, like we know, is to sweep the leaves. And so every day he would sweep the leaves a few times a day. And in about 2 days later, I think he came back and was in tears, crying out of joy to Venerable Ajahn Anand, and I happened to be there. And he said that, oh, I was sweeping and I was looking at each of the color of the leaves, and I could see that some were green, some were orange, some were brown, and that's just like things. They die at different stages of their life. It's uncertain when they're going to die. Just understanding that impermanence, or that nature of impermanence coming up, or perception of impermanence arising, and he had so much joy and got so much faith out of seeing this. And he was in tears like that. And Ajahn Anand told him to ordain in the heart, and to keep one's practice going by ordaining in the heart. Remember, afterwards he had so much faith that he went to offered to treat all the monks of their whatever chiropractic, treating them, you know, aligning their spine, etc. And he did 25 in one day, I remember, and then the next day he finished off all the other monks, 25. And so he had so much faith that he wanted to do that as a dana. And so seeing the bit more into the truth, into impermanence, can be like that. You get so much faith that you're willing to go and to really sort of offer yourself, or to give dana like that. So anyway, so yeah, we contemplate then impermanence every day. It can be very powerful, even though maybe we contemplate and we think that, oh, it's not really bringing much results. But, you know, if we keep it as a habit, it's something like we're building. And so the Buddha wanted us to develop these perceptions, to bring them up, to train in it, to see it more clearly, and something we can do. And so, yeah, so I, yeah, remember once as well that when I was in, I think it was coming back from a trip overseas, and I was coming back with Venerable Ajahn Anand, and we were going back to the monastery in a van, and I was up front. And remember this car coming, cutting us off and driving very fast and dangerously, and then passing us. And because I thought I maybe knew a lot back then, so I thought, my duty is to make sure the driver doesn't get angry, so I'll say the thing that I best think will overcome his anger. And so I said, don't worry about that stupid guy. He'll the karma will get him. And then I remember hearing straight from the back, straight away, Venerable Ajahn Anand says, may they be well and safe. May they go to the hospital and give birth safely. And I look back and all the curtains are closed, and the car is so far ahead. I was like, No way. I think that he could see that or know that it's a pregnant woman going to the hospital. But then thinking of it that, oh, actually, that's such a much more skillful way of thinking about it, or to develop that perception of metta, loving kindness, even if it's someone who's doing something that you dislike, that you hate, someone you hate even, that you can still think, oh, may they be well, may they be safe. No matter who it is, we can develop that metta, that goodwill towards them. And it's a much more skillful way to think like that, because thinking, oh, that they're doing something stupid and their karma will get them, and it's like, that's, you could say that's actually has ill will there. That's not free of ill will or dosa. But the one who wishes them to be safe and well, then that is free from ill will, and that can overcome any ill will. And so the Buddha said that one who has dosa, then they harm themselves, harm others, or harm both, and they will experience mental pain and sadness and suffering. But one who can let go of that dosa, that ill will, anger, hatred, grudge, then they are able to, they're able to not, or they don't harm themselves, harm others. They don't act in their own, for their own suffering. They don't experience mental pain, sadness, and suffering. And this is seeing the Dhamma, the teaching, visible right here, right now, or visible in this very life. And so this is something as well that we have probably experienced in our life, this Dhamma arising, that maybe before we had, or we reacted but through having anger, ill will, or grudge, and we're able to let that go. And you can see the powerful sort of nature of that arising in our heart. That's like that Dhamma there arising right there. And so that can give us a lot more faith and inspiration in the practice, and seeing the results of the practice right there, that we don't harm ourselves, harm others. We have overcome then suffering right there. And so you can say that's a teaching that Ajahn Anand gave me at that time, and something I still remember quite clearly. So later on, I went to Australia when I sp spent about 10 years in Thailand, and went to, my mom had offered a monastery, a land to start a forest monastery, and went there in pretty much my, I think it was 11th year, to stay there and stay to be the abbot there in Bodhisattva Forest Monastery in Sydney, Australia. And in the beginning, it was maybe a bit difficult, like not really sure what to do. But my feeling was that I just bring the tradition that I just practiced in Wakchung, that I've been trained and sort of knew about, and do the same as that in Australia and Sydney. And so one of the teachings or that had was to always go for alms round, or Ajahn Chah saying that we go for alms round not for food but for people. And so I remember then going on alms round, and we just wouldn't really get too much, and people didn't really know what we're doing. Walking bare feet into past their house, there's big group, a lot of houses there, but they didn't really know what we're doing, so mostly not receive anything. I remember there was once when this man, he was on the second floor of his house in the balcony, and he shouted out, "Oh, do you want some shoes?" And he came down and said he's got these shoes, these work boots that he wanted to give, these secondhand ones. And I thought, okay, yeah, sure. And so, we took that, and I thinking back, thinking, oh, maybe actually he saw, he wanted to give something we needed. And so what he saw was not that we needed food, that we needed shoes more than anything, and so that's what he wanted to offer. So that was his dana that he made. But yeah, later on, when the monastery wanted to ask permission for all the buildings and everything, and we had to ask the whole town there that, you know, do you have any objection? Do you object to the monastery being there? And no one had a single objection. It was passed very easily, even though other monks or other places had difficulty with this. We didn't have any. And I think it's because people saw the monks there going on arms round and just were very peaceful, not really, you know, doing anything dangerous or anything they disliked. And there's just a kind of peaceful feeling to it. And they were happy at a monastery being there. And you could say that was their gift that they gave, actually, or to not have any objection. And so, yeah, so just saying this because, yeah, we had a few difficulties, you could say, in the beginning, but it was always trying to bring the tradition there. But remember that, yeah, sometimes before I would have thought that, oh, thinking that, oh, being an abbot would be really good, really easy, the head of the monastery, you know, everyone, you can tell others what to do. Others, people give you the best things, and there's lay people coming in and they, you know, praise you, and you know, you can do what you want. But when you actually be in that position, it's not really like that at all. You could say it's more that you have to let go even more. You have to be able to deal with problems of people, problems of the place, problems of this and that, not just your own, you could say, problems, but other people's problems as well that now you have to deal with. And so Ajahnanan would say that, oh, no matter what position you're in, if you don't have mindfulness and samadhi and wisdom, then whatever it is going to be a burden for you. So no matter if you're a junior monk, you're a lay person, you're an abbot, if you don't have that mindfulness and wisdom, then that thing will be heavy, will be a burden, and end up causing you suffering. And so being an abbot there was learning of how to let go of suffering and how to deal with problems and issues and obstacles. And one teaching I remember that was quite helpful was one that Lumpur Ban, who was the after Lungta Mahabua passed away, you could say Lumpur Ban was the head of the Thai forest tradition, or the Kamatana tradition, is thought of in that way. And so he gave a teaching about that, oh, if you're going to build a monastery, then if you're going to build a monastery, whatever you do, offer it all to the Buddha, and then you'll never get tired. And so this was a very good teaching of whatever it is, you know, whether it's having to maybe physically tired, or there's problems come up that you have to deal with, and it's like whatever it is, sort of offering it to the Buddha, any sort of issues, buildings, that, or they're all given to the Buddha, then there's no self that is created out of it. Or what if people don't appreciate me? What if they think, no, I'm no good, or you know, if it doesn't work out, but if your intention is to give it to the Buddha. And I give this, you could say, teaching, or share this teaching, is because you probably don't have a monastery that you're looking after, but the inner monastery is something you do have, or you're trying to build. This is where Lumpur Ban would say, oh, you have to build the inner monastery, which is the monastery or the dwelling place of sila, of samadhi, of panya, dwelling place of sila, dwelling place of samadhi, dwelling place of panya. So he'd say it's sila what, samadhi what, and panya what. And that's what we're trying to develop, these the Noble Eightfold Path or the training of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. And so we can look at it then that whatever we're going to experience in our lives, that we can all offer it to the Buddha. And this is when they say paribhata, paripati pati puja, is like we're offering our practice to the Buddha, then it doesn't become heavy. It's we don't make a sense of self out of it, and we can progress going closer to the Buddha, the one who brings up mindfulness. Then with every step, they're walking closer to the Buddha, and that's where we're trying to go, to the Buddha, to Nibbana. And so there's, you know, we can bring this into our life. Maybe we set a time when, you know, this meditation retreat, you're doing it as an offering to Buddha, you're developing your mind as an offering to the Buddha. And so whether the mind does become peaceful or not peaceful, in a way you can say it doesn't matter as well, because you have the intention to give all this goodness to the Buddha. And, you know, whatever happens from there, it'll definitely be good because it's coming from a good intention. And later on, then when we finish this meditation retreat, we also can give up a time every day where we're devoting that to meditate, to chant, to give praise to the Buddha, Dhamma Sangha, through chanting, to practice. And then that is something that is building our minds and hearts. We have a woman coming into the monastery and she joins online chanting. And so that starts at 7. So she'll do all her duties in the home. And then at 7, she will, 6:30, then she will sort of turn off all devices, everything, and just say, oh, this is my time. This is when I'm developing the mind. I'm meditating, chanting, listening to Dhamma, and doesn't let anyone sort of disturb her that time. She's done all her duties, finished, and puts the rest down and just focuses on developing the mind. And that doing that every day creates such a strong habit. We have one observance day practice as well in the monastery. And there's someone who says that, oh, they just have to have that one day where they keep the 8 precepts, even just once a week, has such a powerful effect, because if they just let the mind sort of get lost in the world, even keeping the 5 precepts, but getting lost in the world, not stopping, then it just keeps going on and they forget themselves for too long. But just having one day where they come to practice, they keep the 8 precepts, they sort of stop their entertainment, they stop, you know, things that they maybe usually indulge in, and that creates a lot of power in their practice. And so that's something we can determine to do as well. Like maybe through this retreat, we're keeping 8 precepts every day, but afterwards we can also determine how we're going to continue practicing on, because we've already seen the benefits coming up from all of this practice. And so, yeah, there's even whatever situations of suffering that we will experience, we can transform those things into part of the practice. Someone earlier said, oh, lay life is so much suffering. If we're practicing the Buddha's teachings, it shouldn't be suffering. It should be less and less suffering, because we're seeing more into the truth and we're able to let go, and it shouldn't make us suffer. If we're not practicing the Buddha's teaching, then we can say we'll end up suffering more and more. But the suffering that is going to lead us to future happiness and benefit, and that is a suffering that the wise people will endure in order to gain future benefit and happiness. And so that's what you can say you're doing here. You have given up time, given up your efforts. Those who are joining different sessions or the retreat, then this is that you're, it may be difficult, you know, maybe sitting long, having to join, having to give up time, but it's something that will lead eventually to become free from suffering, to be liberated from suffering, to have higher understanding. And so maybe you can say, oh, the great awakening awareness that comes up later is just so great, that, or seeing the Dhamma, but that Dhamma coming up is going to come from the little bits of Dhamma that we see, or the endurance, the patience, the continuation of the practice we have in just little steps every day. That's going to be where we're going to gain the most power, energy from, and leads later to the ultimate seeing of Dhamma, of awakening. There was someone who came, a woman who came, and she asked, oh, can you see Nibbana in this life? And I said, why do you want to see Nibbana? You know, what why do you want to get Nibbana? It's because you read about it or something, that's, you know, and you feel like, oh, that must be the goal, that's what I want to get. If it's like that, then that's not really much use. And this woman actually had a problem, where she was telling me about a problem of, she had a strong grudge about someone and what to do about that. And she had a little anger and upset at someone. And I said, oh, if you can let go of that anger, that grudge, then that's going to be Nibbana for you right there. Because Nibbana means cooling, cooled, extinguished. if you can let go of that dosa, the grudge, the ill will, then Nibbana arises right there, and that's seen right then and there in this very life, in the here and now. And so that's something that she could practice, to see Nibbana, and that would really give benefit to her. But then she said, oh, isn't that temporary? A temporary Nibbana? And I said, oh yeah, it is. It's temporary, but it's going to be the path that's going to lead you to ultimate or permanent, you would say, Nibbana, or the true realization of Nibbana. Just being able to continue on one's developing of sila, samadhi, and panya, growing strength there, and being able to then let go of the defilements in very small ways, in the coarse defilements first, and then later on, defilements, which you know is the five hindrances that obstruct our peacefulness, and then later on, letting go of the defilements, the very deep ones that are is through the development of wisdom. And so all this will become causes for us to see the Dhamma, to be able to have that ultimate letting go and understanding, and weariness, or pulling back from the world and from rebirth. Just as the same insight that Venerable Anya Kodonya had on the day of Asalaha Puja, understanding about all things as being of the nature to arise and the nature to cease. And so we reflect on that, on this time of Asalaha Puja. I hope that then, yeah, may we come closer and closer to this truth of the Dhamma, and hope that this talk gives you some encouragement to be quite, let's say, happy and inspired in your practice, because it's leading in the right way. I mean, to be able to come and listen to Dhamma like this, and join the meditation retreat, and have a great teacher in Venerable Ajahn Anand. I think everyone's very fortunate, and wherever you are at your practice, you can be quite, you know, in a way, you know, quite happy that you're fortunate in that way. And may you have then more motivation, more encouragement to keep continuing it on after this retreat and onwards. And maybe you can say, we're coming together like this, and, you know, encouraging one another, and that's like we're building up strength as a group. And so hopefully we're all kind of heading towards that ultimate liberation, freedom from suffering, by giving each other strength like this. And so wish everyone to have all the best practice, to have to grow in sila, samadhi, and panya, and may this lead you to the ultimate happiness, the liberation from all suffering to nibbana.
Tamayango wa takata satu garangata mase satu satu satu.